It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. According to census estimates, there's been an increase in the number of Latino and Asian immigrants in Pittsburgh over the last several years. Advocacy group Jewish Family and Community Services indicates that this year so far, there's been a bit of an uptick in the number of refugees arriving in Pittsburgh. So what is the Pittsburgh community doing to help these new residents get settled? Joining us in studio is Leslie Eisenman, Director of Refugee and Immigrant Services at Jewish Family and Community Services. Leslie, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
Leslie, Jewish Family and Community Services, the lead partner in a collaboration known as Immigrant Services and Connections. Who comprises this partnership?
So Immigrant Services and Connections, which we call ISAC, is a five-agency partnership led by JFCS with two Latino partners, Casa San Jose, Latino Family Center of the AIU, along with Literacy Pittsburgh, and SHIM, South Hills Interfaith Ministries.
All right.
Interfaith Movement, sorry. It's okay. A new name.
Okay. And of course, AIU is Allegheny Intermediate.
Yes.
All right. So what's the overall mission of this collaboration?
So ISAC came about as a result of a needs assessment by Allegheny County Department of Human Services. And through this needs assessment, it was determined that vulnerable refugees and immigrants with barriers of language and culture have trouble accessing existing services in Allegheny County. So that's the premise of ISAC. We're a connector for refugees and immigrants. We make it very easy to get access through the five agencies. We also have lots of community sites where people can come in with their issues. We also work with providers so that they can make their services more available using interpretation and understanding cultural competency.
So are the services there, it's just access and maybe even awareness about the services?
Yes, it's helping them maybe just a little because they have the English to navigate systems, or we may enroll them in service coordination where they have a service coordinator who creates goals based on what they want to do, and then they work with them over a period of months to access the services they need. Some of the more challenging services are around health care, mental health care, maybe around family issues at school, children at school. So we have a lot of housing. You know, you need the language and the understanding of the culture to really make your way with a lot of the systems.
So the language is the bridge to all of the services.
The language and the understanding of the culture, yes. So we are sort of expert in helping people access the services and then helping the providers provide the services in a culturally competent way.
So how does this goal, this mission of the collaboration, does that impact the individual missions of the partners?
All the partners are immigrant-serving agencies, and yes, the big key is to help them integrate and thrive in Allegheny County. So if they need employment, we know where they can turn. If they need legal immigration help, we know where they can turn. Health care, health insurance, like I said, housing, working public assistance, all the different offices which we are mostly all expert in, and certainly a refugee resettlement agency is expert in. This just expands our audience to people who are here for all different types of reasons in our community.
Mm-hmm. An immigrant, of course, is someone who chooses to resettle in another country. A refugee is someone who is forced to flee
right.
their home country. JFCS is one of two refugee
yes.
settlement agencies in the Pittsburgh area.
Yes.
So what does that mean? How does it impact your work?
So JFCS and AJAPO are the two refugee agencies in Pittsburgh. We work with one of nine national agencies. We work with HIAS. And HIAS works directly with the State Department, which is, and the number of refugees who come is determined by the president and his cabinet. So we help those that are coming to Pittsburgh through the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program. They may come here because they may know no one here and we'll set them up, or they may come because a friend or a family member is here. And right now we're seeing more and more of our refugees living here already requesting that their friends and family come to Pittsburgh. So for at the moment, we are seeing more refugees come than we have in 2 years.
So why the decline over 2 years? And do you have an understanding of why the uptick over the last few months?
So as I mentioned, the president decides how many refugees and which refugees can come to the United States. And currently, President Trump has set the cap at 30,000 refugees during the entire year. And at the same time, smaller refugee agencies across the U.S. had to close. And in some cities with many refugee agencies had to consolidate. So that could mean why we're getting more in Pittsburgh, just because there's fewer local agencies. And also people are requesting to come here.
Oh, okay. So fewer agencies, so maybe more for each of those
right.
agencies. I mentioned that uptick, and you just told us the reason why. Is it across the board, around the world, certain peoples from certain countries having to flee those countries?
I just think that right now Pittsburgh is seeing this little uptick. Overall, the numbers are very much lower because 30,000 is the lowest cap, I believe, since the refugee program started. So we are very happy that our caseworkers are busy, and this keeps our program, you know, running, and we are here to help them. So as long as they're coming, we will make it happen.
Where are they coming from, though?
Predominantly Congo, which means that they fled the Congo, some of them decades ago, and are in surrounding countries like Burundi, Rwanda, Uganda, Tanzania. We're also getting a small number of what they call special immigrant visa holders, slightly different than a refugee, from Afghanistan. So these are people who in some way help the U.S., whether they're a business or the government, and they come and they have a green card upon arrival, but they go through the U.S. refugee program.
Mm-hmm. Any idea why Congo? Why this?
Well, the Congo is considered one of the most dangerous places in the world. There's a lot of violence and war and very unsafe place. These people have been in camps for a long time. So the U.S. does look at the amount of time and the atrocities. And this is a group that our president and cabinet are willing to take.
Mm-hmm. Is there much of a Congolese community in the Pittsburgh region at this point?
There are small numbers of people who came here as immigrants, but this group coming from the eastern part of the Congo, there's not much of a community at this time. So we are involved in establishing a community and supporting that. We run peer-led support groups in the Congolese and in actually refugee and immigrant communities. This is a really great program where we find leaders in the refugee and immigrant community to recruit and lead groups of their own people to help them become stronger together, access services, get information. So we see this as a way of building community.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our special guest is Leslie Eisenman, Director of Refugee and Immigrant Services at Jewish Family and Community Services. Leslie, we mentioned just a few minutes ago that yours is one of two refugee settlement agencies in the Pittsburgh area. Your organization's been doing this for 45 years, is that correct? More than 45 years.
The agency is over 80 years old, since 1937, and it was helping Jews fleeing Europe after World War II. So there's a long history, there's a long commitment. It's a mission of our agency to help people who are fleeing violence and to help them start over in a new country, in a new city.
So during that time period, has your organization, and for the time that you've worked there, have you noticed any change in the needs for the refugees coming to this area? Have they changed?
Yes. So while in the past, most refugees were fleeing countries more westernized, maybe Europe, former Soviet Union, now we're seeing people from Southeast Asia, from Africa, people who need a little more help and support longer term and really need the interpretation services almost anywhere they go. So definitely seeing the need to advocate more so people serve them. These are people who may speak five languages that they will get English, but when they first come, they really need that hands-on special assistance and help navigating their new world here.
What would you say, what kind of misconceptions are there either about refugees or immigrants that you encounter regularly?
Well, I believe these people are about as strong and resourceful and resilient as anyone. They, like I said, they speak many languages. They are risk takers, and having given up everything to start over. I find the cultural benefits and rich cultures that they come from, and they do want to integrate into the U.S. They do want to learn the language. They do want their kids to go to school. They think about college, and they have a lot of barriers to overcome. So I just find the richness and the strength and their worldview is very special.
Hey, just a couple minutes left. I understand that when refugees arrive, they receive like a one-time sum from the State Department to help expenses for like the first month. Are they expected to become economically self-sufficient quickly?
Yes.
I mean, how does that work when you have a new culture, language issues?
This whole program is predicated on what they call early economic self-sufficiency. And the amount they get from the United States is very small, and it means that someone in the household needs to work, in fact, from anywhere from 3 months to 6 months upon arrival. So that money is meant to give them a little cushion of 2 to 3 months, and our employment team, amazing team, working closely with employers and making sure that our clients are job ready and they go off to work. And actually in Pittsburgh right now, there's a great need for these entry level types of workers.
Well, let's talk about need in this last minute. So what are the gaps in how refugees are helped in the U.S. or specifically Pittsburgh? What needs to be improved upon and how?
Well, I mean, our biggest challenge is finding housing upon arrival. We get about 2-3 weeks notification of arrival, and we need to find safe, affordable housing on a bus line. So if there's anybody, property managers, housing people out there, we are always looking for this type of accommodation. We also need, you know, we have English language partners, but needing to go to work so fast, it means that, you know, that English can be on hold. But just a warm welcome would be the most we could ask.
Leslie Eisenman is the Director of Refugee and Immigrant Services at Jewish Family and Community Service. Leslie, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, national statistics show that rural students attend and complete four-year colleges at lower rates than their urban and suburban counterparts. A new school in northern Pennsylvania is setting out to change that by addressing access and cost. And the Trump administration is lowering the number of refugees accepted into the U.S. by a third. So how will that impact local agencies when there's already a surge in H-1B visa applications from foreign workers with special skills? Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Julia Zankovich with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the St. Patrick's Day flood of 1936. A harsh winter producing nearly 63 inches of snow followed by a sudden spring thaw combined to cause the worst flooding in Pittsburgh history. River levels reached a peak of 46 feet at the Point, more than 20 feet over flood stage, devastating thousands of downtown buildings. By the time the water receded a week later, it was determined that 62 people were dead, 500 injured, and 135,000 people were homeless. Levels of the 1936 flood lines can still be seen on some buildings in downtown Pittsburgh. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The flats, slopes, and riverfront on Pittsburgh's south side are all part of what gives the neighborhood its distinctive feel. 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook has more on a group of volunteers working to make the community a cleaner, safer, and more vibrant place to work and live.
Whether it's the middle of the day or the middle of the night, the South Side is bustling with activity in and around its coffee shops, bars, shops, and restaurants. The South Side Community Council is a volunteer group that acts as the glue that holds together homeowners, businesses, and advocates for the neighborhood's residents.
It helps us better understand what's happening here on the South Side as it relates to parking, as it relates to crime, as it relates to Carson Street activity. It's an opportunity for residents to come to speak about some of the issues that they've had difficulty having remedied.
Barbara Rudiak, president of the Southside Community Council, says she and other board members engage community members about problems in the area, then form strategic plans to address them.
One in particular, you know, parking is a significant issue on the south side, and many residents will be upset if a car is parked in front of a fire hydrant or somewhere that is dangerous when you're thinking about fire trucks getting by or emergency vehicles.
In addition to planning for the South Side's future, Rudiak says it's also important to preserve the neighborhood's past, which the council has set out to do with a recorded oral history series called South Side Voices.
With every passing day, we lose history told by the people who have lived it. And what we did, we started to do last year, was record the stories of residents. And within those stories, we heard a lot about, you know, the churches they may have gone to or the family experiences. But it gave us an opportunity to capture some of our history, and it's something that we'll continue doing.
In the 40s, 50s, 60s, community was created organically by the ethnic group that you were born into and how that group interacted with all the other ethnic groups down here.
Board member Frank Vitale.
But when the mills closed in the late 70s, early 80s, all that went away. And so what I see the community council doing in an unspoken way is creating community, but also the very fact that you are bringing people together.
Vitale says bringing residents closer together and building positive relationships is one of the council's overarching goals.
People who wouldn't necessarily know each other or would have met each other down here now are friends.
Barbara Rudiak says the work of the Southside Community Council, the beautification of parks and streets, the upkeep of homes and businesses is never ending. But the reward of a closer community is well worth the work.
As we continue with the work of the Community Council, we want you to be safe and have a good quality of life.
I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. At the Allegheny County Courthouse tomorrow, a white police officer goes on trial for fatally shooting an unarmed black teen last summer. The jury comes from the Harrisburg area after a judge ruled that pretrial publicity in Pittsburgh posed a threat to a fair trial. 90.5 WESA's Anlie Herring reports.
It was around 9 p.m. on June 19th that East Pittsburgh Borough Officer Michael Rossfeld pulled over a car that had been involved in a drive-by shooting just minutes earlier. His gun drawn, he ordered the three occupants out of the vehicle and to the ground. Suddenly, the two passengers bolted. One of them was Antoine Rose, who Rossfeld shot three times while he was fleeing. Rose had no weapon, and just last week, the other fleeing suspect pleaded guilty to firing the shots in the drive-by. Someone in a nearby house caught the shooting on video, posting it on Facebook hours later.
And so this time, before the police could create a narrative that would justify the shooting of Antoine, we saw the video. We saw him running away.
That's activist Jasiri X, who helped lead protests last summer that stretched out for weeks after Rose's death.
Three shots in the back, I didn't justify that! Three shots!
For the demonstrators and others, Rose's death fit a national pattern of police brutality against black residents. A week after the shooting, County District Attorney Stephen Zappala charged Michael Rossfeld with homicide.
You do not shoot somebody in the back if they are not a threat to you.
The DA said Officer Rossfeld did not face a threat of death or serious bodily injury when Rose ran away from him, and added that after the shooting, the officer gave conflicting accounts of whether he thought the fleeing victim was armed. But Rossfeld's attorney, Patrick Tomasi, says the fact that Rose was in a car involved in a drive-by shooting should be taken into account.
This car was involved in an attempted murder. That's why it's being stopped. It's not being stopped from going through a stop sign. People in that car, whoever, just tried to kill somebody.
Tomasi says the jury should hear that Rose had a gun magazine in his pocket when he was killed. The lawyer says it's crucial to showing the car the teen was in was part of a felony in progress. But the government argues that the evidence is not relevant because it says Rossfeld couldn't have known Rose was carrying the magazine when he fired his weapon. Pittsburgh civil rights attorney Tim O'Brien says the jury will need to decide whether the officer could reasonably have seen Rose as a threat. He notes that the law gives police the benefit of the doubt and says Rossfeld's lawyer will argue a number of factors.
That the officer's ability to observe wasn't as clear because it was dark, because of where he was standing, that he misinterpreted something that he saw, and that it was a mistake.
This case also reveals something we've seen in other police departments across the country: the lack of a policy on when to use deadly force. DA Zappala criticized the now-defunct East Pittsburgh Police Department for apparently having no policies in substantive areas. University of Pittsburgh law professor and WESA legal analyst David Harris says this fact will likely be part of the defense.
I was trained this way. I did what I was trained to do. I did not go outside the training. That's what his contention will be.
Activist Jasiri X says no matter what the defense argues, he hopes the video will convince jurors.
Video of a young man running away unarmed being shot 3 times in the back. It should be open and closed, and the fact that it's not is super problematic.
Since the jurors live 200 miles away, the trial will run through the week and into the weekend if necessary. Pittsburgh officials are taking extra security measures around the courthouse and say they're prepared for possible unrest, depending on what the verdict is. Anlie Herring, 90.5 WESA News.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Nationally, statistics show that rural students attend and complete four-year colleges at lower rates than their urban and suburban counterparts. In Pennsylvania, rural students face two big obstacles: cost and access. As Keystone Crossroads' Min Xian reports, there's a new school in the northern tier of the state that's out to change that.
Kathy Wells started her career early. She didn't get a chance to go to college after graduating high school in rural northwestern Pennsylvania.
You know, large family, small area. You know, you work, you don't go to school, so.
Now 48, Wells is an administrative assistant for the school district in Forest County. It's one of the most remote areas of the state. A few years ago, she decided she wanted to get her associate's degree, but she faced an obstacle common for some parts of the area where you could go more than 70 miles before finding a college campus. That's when she learned about Northern Pennsylvania Regional College.
It's a challenge, but I'm enjoying it. The course that I'm doing right now, since I've been in the accounting field my whole life, I'm understanding what I'm learning, and it's benefiting more of my ability to perform in my job now.
The two-year regional college is not like typical schools. It has what it calls a non-traditional delivery system. Instead of having one central campus where all students go, there's a network of satellite classrooms in schools or libraries across the region where students and instructors are connected through real-time video conferencing.
Now, if you want to look at these when we're done with tonight's class, all this material is on the Gannon Blackboard.
On a recent open house, IT specialist Gary Saltel showcased how multiple classrooms interact with each other.
But these little screens down here are the classroom sites where students are connecting.
The college now has 18 classroom locations across 9 northern counties, including Warren, McKean, Potter, and Erie. For Wells, that convenience is key. She prefers a physical environment over an online program, which she says keeps her disciplined with her studies. And since the college has a classroom location at the school district, she doesn't have to travel for many of her classes.
For me, I usually just stay here and do my homework or do reading or whatever between work life and school life. I'm able to organize my schedule like that.
The college's founding president, Joseph Nairn, says satellite classrooms also make the college more affordable.
We've taken away is all of that additional expense that students often incur. We're not supporting a a residence hall system. We're not supporting a food service. We don't have a gymnasium or physical plant to manage.
The rising cost of college tuition can be daunting for many families, especially those in rural areas that have seen jobs and opportunities leave. Dr. Kai Shaft is with the Center on Rural Education and Communities at Penn State.
Logistically, it's just more difficult for rural students to go to college or to go to university because of the distance that they have to travel and the costs that are associated with that.
Having a more affordable college option means a lot to Margot Lautzenheiser. She's currently a senior at a high school in Warren County, doing a dual enrollment program at the regional college. Lautzenheiser pays $60 per credit hour at MPRC for dual enrollment, about one-seventh of what she would have paid for a similar program she considered.
And this is way cheaper than that.
She says it's also easy to learn using technology, and just because this is different doesn't mean it's less of a college experience.
You can see them, you can interact with them, you can talk to them just like you normally would, just you have to press a button.
Back in Forest County, Kathy Wells says she feels confident taking on more responsibility at work as she learns new skills.
Being able to get the degree at this later stage, that is actually kind of a life-building experience as well.
Kai Shaft cautions that while programs like this could get more rural students to attend college, the question of whether students can use their education in the region remains open.
There are some questions about whether these are degrees that can actually be used in the home environment.
Shaft says if rural students are not able to utilize their degrees in the area, it's likely they will move away to seek employment, which could accelerate rural population loss. I'm Min Chen, Keystone Crossroads.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
WYEP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out more about Exene Cervenka. In 1976, poet and visual artist Exene Cervenka began dating rock musician John Doe. The pair married and became musical partners in the seminal Los Angeles punk band X, sharing writing and singing duties. Cervenka took part in the X side project, The Knitters, recording country, rockabilly, and folk songs. In 1987, Exene Cervenka starred in the indie film Salvation, a parody of televangelism. She married co-star Viggo Mortensen and moved to Idaho. In 1989, she released her first solo album, Old Wives' Tales. To hear full songs from all of our featured artists for Women's History Month, go to WYEP.org/women.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The window to file for H-1B visas for foreign citizens with special skills closes in early April. How does the Trump administration's plan for these visas fit into the overall policy on immigrants and refugees? What's the impact of these visas on Pittsburgh businesses? Joel Pfeffer is a partner with Pittsburgh-based law firm Meyer, Unkovic & Scott, and he specializes in the areas of immigration, nationality, and corporate law. Joel, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin.
Before we get to those big questions I just mentioned, remind us, what is the purpose of an H-1B visa?
The purpose of an H-1B visa is to offer U.S. companies the opportunity to employ professionals, filling professional positions and paying them the prevailing wage. Everybody who works in the United States is either a citizen or a permanent resident, meaning someone with a green card who's here permanently, or in some kind of temporary status. And the principal temporary status that is available to all foreign nationals is the H-1B category. There are one or two other temporary statuses available to specific individuals by country or by experience or by a relationship with a multinational company. But the one that is the that's most commonly used for foreign nationals and is available to citizens of all countries is the H-1B.
Mm-hmm. Now, what qualifications does a person have to have to even be considered?
The individual, the foreign national who is going to work for a U.S. company must have a professional degree or experience that equates to a professional degree. So in the H-1B category, there's a 3-for-1 rule. 3 years of experience on a professional level equals 1 year of college. So somebody can either have a bachelor's degree or something short of a bachelor's degree and supplemented with experience. In addition, the position itself must be a professional position in that a college degree is an entry-level requirement, and there are publications by the Department of Labor that instruct the Department of Homeland Security on how to determine that. Mm-hmm. And this position must be a professional position, and the employer must pay what's called the prevailing wage. And it's typically based on statistics published by the Department of Labor.
Is the number of H-1B visas being awarded, is that changing at all?
No. The number has been set for a number of years now. I believe it changed during the Clinton years. It used to be higher, but now there are 85,000 visas available, 65,000 to professionals, and an additional 20,000 to graduates of U.S. master's programs. So anybody with a U.S. master's degree has an additional opportunity in those extra 20,000 slots.
Okay, seven, another chance, and chance implies lottery, and that's how they're selected, through a lottery system?
Yes, and this year the Trump administration has changed the precise way that the lottery is conducted to give a slightly better opportunity to somebody with a U.S. master's degree.
So the Trump administration might be looking for people with more advanced degrees.
They've tinkered with the way the lottery is done in order to make it better, even more, to increase slightly the chances of someone with a U.S. master's degree to get in.
Do we really not have enough qualified American workers for the positions that are available that the companies feel they have to go outside the U.S. to recruit?
Well, there definitely are positions that there are not skill. The skill set is not available in the United States. For example, if you have a company in Pittsburgh, for example, that makes a certain product and wants to expand on that product, a technical product, and the technology for that product was developed abroad, and they want to bring an engineer, for example, to work with them to expand their production in this cutting edge technology. Then yes, there probably would not be anybody in the United States available to do this. Mm-hmm. And the only practical way of bringing this individual here to do this work is through the H-1B lottery. There are opportunities through green cards, but green cards take much longer and involve a test of the U.S. labor market. But on the other hand, I would say that there are many positions in the H-1B lottery that are filled by students who are just graduating, they're entry level. They're filled by they're filling positions that perhaps there are skill sets in America that could fill those positions.
How would you assess the interest overall in the Pittsburgh region of employers in the H-1B system? Is there a lot of interest? What types of companies are interested in participating?
Well, we're seeing all kinds of companies participating in this program. The kinds of individuals they seek to hire are professionals. We see accountants, but for the most part, we see business professionals, professional managers, engineers, and software professionals. Mm-hmm. And companies that hire those skill sets are the ones that participate generally in this H-1B lottery.
Now, we mentioned it's a lottery system a few different times, but do areas of the country, regions of the country, get so many here, so many there, or not?
No, it's all national. Everything is conducted on a national level, and there's no preference to any part of the country, to any kind of specific business category, or everything is just straight up a national lottery.
Is this strictly for the private sector business employees? What about universities maybe looking for faculty members from abroad? Are they part of the system or not?
They are entitled to H-1Bs, but they're not subject to this cap. The technical term is a cap.
Okay.
They're not subject to the cap. They are exempt. So H-1Bs are available to them any time of the year, and without any numeric limitation. This is very advantageous here in this area because there are many universities that employ H-1B professionals, and particularly researchers and professors, and they are able to obtain these visas without any limitation.
We talked about the qualifications that are necessary and the skill set that companies might be interested in from foreign workers. But what about scrutiny from the Department of Homeland Security? What role does that play in the overall process?
In recent years, the Department of Homeland Security has been very highly scrutinized these petitions to determine whether, in fact, the individual has a professional degree and whether a professional degree is required for the position. So we're seeing an increased level of scrutiny, responses, request for additional evidence, particularly in cases where the person is a business manager or another business professional, questioning whether or not this job could be done by someone without a college degree, whether the application of skills studied on the post-secondary level is necessary to perform that job. And then there's a second level of scrutiny is when the individual applies for the visa itself at a consular post abroad. There again, the consular officers are seeking to make a determination about the person's experience and professional standing and whether or not these positions are in fact qualified for H-1B. So there's two levels of scrutiny in this.
What about the Trump administration's trade policies? Do they impact H-1B visa process? In particular, I'm thinking about the sometimes tense trade relations between the U.S. and China.
Some have argued that there is a higher level of scrutiny in Chinese cases, particularly at the second level when an individual applies at a consular post in China. I can't say that I've seen that, but it's been argued. It's been also suggested that the Department of State is interested in reducing the amount of time that a visa can be issued for in certain categories for individuals from China. No one has been able to establish, to my knowledge, that there is a relationship here.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about the changes this year. Do you anticipate those changes will make the process more, less effective, more efficient, slow things down?
Well, I think that it's not going to change the system this year, but for next year, the government has announced that it will do something that will make the system more efficient in the sense that today, this year, and in prior years, it has been necessary for a petitioning company to file a full-fledged petition with all of the evidentiary requirements, which can be significant and a lot of work in order to get in the lottery, in order to be selected in the lottery. Next year, the government has announced that there will be a different system, and that is you will just enter yourself in the lottery, and if you are selected, then you will file your petition and supporting documents and meet the evidentiary requirements to make a determination whether the position is qualified. So I expect that to streamline the process next year.
We have just about 30 seconds. Earlier in the program, we were talking about the administration's cutting the number of refugees accepted into the country. You've been specializing in immigration law for many years. How does maybe the refugee issue, the changes to the H-1B visas, how does that impact the overall, how do they play in the overall Trump policy?
Well, it sends a message that the government is interested in buy American, hire American, and that's part of the government's agenda. I think the refugee, the reduction in the numbers reduces the unskilled labor that comes into the United States, and unskilled labor is a problem that we've not solved. How do we determine what are our needs in unskilled labor, and how do we get them into the country? H-1B doesn't address that.
Joel Pfeffer is a partner and immigration attorney with the Pittsburgh-based law firm Meyer, Unkovic & Scott. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, a conversation with University of Pittsburgh Chancellor Patrick Gallagher, who's marking 5 years at that post. We'll talk about the future of Pitt and public universities in general, plus the ongoing college admissions bribery scandal. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Mick Stinelli, Joya Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.